Welcome to Radio Zine, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. The Office of District Attorney is an elected position, and in the upcoming May election, Washington County voters have two choices. My guest is Brian Decker, candidate for District Attorney of Washington County, Oregon. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Brian, talk about your background.
I've been a public defender for over 4 years here in Washington County, which means I've been the defense lawyer who's appointed to represent people who can't afford to hire their own lawyer when they're accused of crimes. I have also been a federal prosecutor in the Justice Department during the Obama administration, which means I've been the lawyer who has charged people with crimes in federal court. I have also volunteered to represent victims of domestic violence when they are seeking restraining orders against people who have harmed them. I have volunteered to represent detainees at Guantanamo Bay back in the day. And so over the course of my career, mainly focusing on criminal justice, I've worked in many different roles in the justice system and seen things from many different perspectives. And what I've seen is a need for a balanced approach in the criminal justice system, something that incorporates some meaningful reforms, because the system as it exists, the status quo, is causing a lot of harm and a lot of bad outcomes for a lot of communities, in particular here in Washington County.
A county district attorney is given an enormous amount of discretion within the law. In the upcoming May election, why should Washington County voters give this responsibility to you?
Well, that's exactly right. And I recognize that it is a tremendous power and a tremendous responsibility that comes with this position of district attorney. The district attorney, as the lawyer in charge of the office that prosecutes all the crimes in the county every single year, gets to set the policies that make the decisions that drive the outcomes of all of those thousands of cases. So decisions about what crimes to charge, the number of crimes, their severity, decisions about whom to charge, decisions about whether or not to dismiss the case, what plea bargain they're going to offer, and whether that's something that drives somebody toward incarceration or drives somebody toward rehabilitation and treatment, what sentence they're going to recommend, and whether or not to request cash bail or insist on keeping somebody in jail before they've had their day in court. Collectively, all of those decisions are what the law calls prosecutorial discretion. In Washington County, we prosecute over 9,000 cases every single year. And in every single one of those 9,000 cases, the DA's office gets to exercise prosecutorial discretion. Even that number of cases, 9,000, is a product of the DA's office deciding and exercising that prosecutorial discretion, determining what kinds of cases they're going to prioritize and what kind of cases they're going to ignore. Most cases nationwide never go to trial. They end up with a plea bargain. And it's over 90% of cases nationwide. Here in Washington County, it's almost 97% of cases that end in guilty pleas. And in those cases, it's not a jury that decides the outcome. It's not even really a judge that decides the outcome. It's the decisions of the district attorney about what crimes are being charged, what pleas are being offered, what sentences are being recommended that determine what specific sentence is going to happen in that case and whether the person is going to be incarcerated or treated and rehabilitated. All of which is to say that this prosecutorial discretion, if it is wielded fanatically, as I have seen it be wielded here in Washington County, it can drive up mass incarceration. It can coerce guilty pleas. It can waste tax dollars. It can ruin lives. It can gut neighborhoods. And when used reasonably, as I intend to use it, prosecutorial discretion can reverse those trends and move the community forward by prioritizing rehabilitation and prevention.
And as you said, Brian, for the past 4 years, you worked as a public defender in Washington County. Now, do most DAs have this experience, and why is it important?
Most district attorneys don't, at least historically. The kinds of people who end up becoming your district attorney stay as the district attorney for decades and then pass the baton to the next in line at the office. And that's what we've seen for the past several decades here in Washington County. And that's what we have now in Washington County is an elected DA in Kevin Barton, who was the second in command to the previous DA. And he's largely spent his entire career in that one office, doing that one job, working his way up and seeing things from that very narrow perspective. Now, there are district attorneys who have diverse experience and who bring something more to the table when considering the full scope of the district attorney's powers. So I look across the country and at places like Northern Virginia, suburban Denver, suburban Chicago, Athens, Georgia. These are places where folks who have served as either public defenders or civil rights attorneys, somebody who has other experience in the criminal justice system, bring something new and suggests that we can effect some real change through the district attorney's powers rather than just maintaining the status quo, rather than just continuing to drive it in the quote unquote tough on crime, war on drugs, same direction that we've seen things go since Nixon, Reagan, you know, Willie Horton ads and Donald Trump, that same kind of regressive rhetoric of criminality and fear that has gotten us to where we are today.
In 2019, and over the objections of most prosecutors, Oregon legislators passed Senate Bill 1008, which changed the way juveniles convicted of aggravated murder get sentenced. There is no longer life without parole. They are now eligible for second look hearings after years in prison. Senate Bill 1008 was not retroactive, so Oregon Governor Brown may use her clemency powers to allow people convicted as youth who are not eligible for these hearings to apply for clemency. So Washington County DA Kevin Barton opposes releasing these individuals who he says were convicted as juveniles of violent crimes such as murder, rape, assault, and manslaughter. Do you support giving individuals a second look hearing and possible release?
I absolutely support looking back at these old cases that were handled under a different law. And now that we have changed the law to recognize what science has been telling us, which is that youths have brains that work differently than adults, that the juvenile brain doesn't fully develop until age 25 in boys, particularly in areas of executive function that affect decision-making, impulsivity, peer pressure, risk-taking, the kinds of things that lead to criminal behavior in a lot of cases. Now that we do recognize that, we have gone ahead and changed the law. And 1008 does, you know, the things that you were saying. 1008 also reformed the way that we charge juveniles with other serious crimes as well, because instead of naturally filing them and charging juveniles as adults with mandatory minimum sentences, now they always start off in juvenile court. And if a district attorney believes they in a particular case that it warrants treatment as an adult, then the district attorney goes to a judge and tries to prove it. 1008 is a sensible reform and a needed reform to give a path to rehabilitation for juveniles that were not afforded an opportunity under that same old regime of decades past. And it is no surprise that Kevin Barton is using the rhetoric of fear to complain about any steps that might be taken to allow youths to petition for a chance at a second look, to go into court and ask to show that they deserve to be let out early and put on supervision instead of finishing out these long adult prison terms that they had been sentenced to under an earlier regime. Kevin Barton opposed 1008 juvenile justice reform when it was taken up and passed at the legislature. He's continued to rail against it since then. He is the most vocal opponent to any sort of criminal justice reform statewide, where it is a kind of reform that would reduce his leverage to wield his prosecutorial discretion in a fanatical way and try to coerce as many guilty pleas and get as many convictions as he possibly can. Anytime you hear that there is a reform being contemplated by the legislature or by the voters by ballot measure, and you wonder who's going to be on the opposition side, you pick up the phone and call Kevin Barton, because he's the one who's on the opposition side. He's the one who gets interviewed on the news every single time with this rhetoric of people should be very afraid of criminals and we need to crack down on them, instead of the more level-headed, sensible reforms that we've seen have actually helped promote safety and promote health and stability in society in recent years.
And some of the reasons youth are serving harsh and excessive sentences is our mandatory minimum sentencing, which fundamentally shifted power from the judges to the district attorneys. But in recent years, some Oregon DAs have voiced their opposition to Measure 11, which is Oregon's one-strike-you're-out mandatory minimum sentencing law. So would you actively work to repeal or reform Measure 11?
Yeah, I recognize that the kinds of crimes that are listed in Measure 11 are the most serious crimes and more often than not deserve the most serious consequences. And we need to hold people accountable who commit those crimes. But here's the problem with mandatory minimum sentences. When people look at that list of crimes, when voters look at that list of crimes, when legislators look at that list of crimes and think, what is a robbery in the second degree? They picture the archetype. They picture, two people holding up a convenience store, right? They picture what you might see in the movies as a robbery in the second degree. And there's a disconnect between what you imagine when you're a voter and a legislator picturing that list of crimes and the decisions that the district attorney makes when exercising prosecutorial discretion. When the district attorney is examining a case, if what they're trying to do is to get as many convictions and get people into prison and jail as much as possible, then what they're going to do is charge as serious a crime as possible to fit whatever facts come in, which means when they look at a case coming in, they look not at the archetype of robbery in the second degree. They look at the least culpable possible case that they can conceivably fit into robbery in the second degree. And so in Washington County, I've seen multiple cases where, for example, you have two 18-year-old high school students after school, jump and punch some other kid in their class and run off with his backpack. I'm not saying that's good behavior. That's bad. That is hurting people. That is harming people. And people need to be held accountable for that. But that gets charged as robbery in the second degree on the theory that you can meet those elements of that Measure 11 offense. And robbery in the second degree has a mandatory minimum sentence of around 6 years. Nobody thinks that some 18-year-old who's never been in trouble before in his life with the law needs to go to prison for 6 years. Nobody, not even the regressive district attorney who charges robbery in the second degree on those facts, thinks that that kid deserves to go to prison for 6 years. But they charge it anyway because it gives them the leverage to coerce that kid into taking whatever plea bargain they're willing to offer. It takes the power away from the judge and from any other actor in the system to determine what the outcome of the case is going to be, because the district attorney controls whether that gets charged with a mandatory minimum sentence that is completely unacceptable and unjust in the eyes of everybody, or take it or leave it, take the plea bargain that you're given. And that's why we see so many of these cases, 97% of cases in Washington County have no day in court at all and instead get a plea bargain. So that's the real purpose of mandatory minimums, is to give that power to district attorneys to wield their prosecutorial discretion in this fanatical way. And that needs to stop. I was in juvenile defense my first year in Washington County as a public defender. I was representing teens and preteens who were charged as quote unquote juvenile delinquents. And I saw teens charged with felonies for things like driving their parents' car without permission or borrowing their parents' credit card without permission, on the theory that borrowing a credit card without permission constitutes fraudulent use of a credit card, which is a felony. And I'm not going to say, again, that that's good behavior. That is misbehavior. Teens should not be using their parents' credit card without permission. But it doesn't need to be criminalized. It doesn't need to be felonized. We don't need to be institutionalizing youth for typical adolescent misbehavior. And yet, that's exactly what the Washington County District Attorney has been doing. In fact, the rate at which the district attorney formally charges youths as juvenile delinquents, as opposed to diverting them into community service or any sort of alternative to incarceration and prosecution, the rate at which they get formal charges as delinquents has increased 53% in just the first 3 years of Kevin Barton's term. We are going in the wrong direction. We are going in the hyper-incarceration, mass incarceration direction, even when it comes to youths, because of this fanatical misuse of prosecutorial discretion.
In March 2018, Albert Molina was arrested for allegedly riding a bicycle while intoxicated. During booking in the Washington County Jail, Deputy Ryan Alden brutally assaulted Albert Molina. In a video of the incident, the assault appears unprovoked, and Molina suffered a traumatic brain hemorrhage, a skull fracture, and other injuries, and he was awarded $625,000 by Washington County. So District Attorney Kevin Barton failed to take immediate action against Deputy Ryan Alden. What steps will you take to hold law enforcement accountable?
Well, look, we've got to hold everybody who commits a crime accountable, and nobody should get special treatment. Not law enforcement, not corporations, not wealthy, well-connected people. We've got to treat everybody equally. And historically, the problem has been that law enforcement has a very well-connected relationship with the district attorneys who make these decisions. Law enforcement police officers tend to be witnesses in a lot of cases. They tend to be the investigators who district attorneys will say, you know, can you go interview this person? Can you go collect more evidence for this particular case? So they have a very cozy working relationship. And that means historically they've been sort of lucky enough to be in the in-group that will get the benefit of the doubt from district attorneys making charging decisions and all their other discretionary decisions that the general public doesn't get, that poor people don't get, that Black and brown people don't get. And that's got to change. We've got to immunize against that cozy relationship between prosecutors and police in order to hold police accountable in the same way that we hold everybody else accountable. You know, police are human beings, just like other human beings. Some of them commit crimes, but they don't deserve special treatment. In fact, when some police commit crimes, it's worse than when the general population commits crimes, because it's not just the harm of the crime itself. It's also the additional harm of seeing somebody in a position of power, a position of public trust, a position where we as a society have entrusted the police with the ability to wield force responsibly and legitimately, to see that abused and to face that head on for victims, for survivors, for the public as a whole is a rude awakening and something that can shake your sense of trust and your sense of order in society. So we've got to hold police officers accountable. Now, the Ryan Alden case in particular is a difficult example for Kevin Barton, because it's not just that they neglected to charge the jail deputy initially. They affirmatively decided that they would not. They wrote out a memo and made the determination that this was not going to charge this person. And it's not that any facts significantly changed over the course of 2 years. It's not that new evidence came to light. Everything else was available. The person had been harmed. The guy had been put in the hospital. The video was there and they had it. And they decided that there wasn't enough evidence to charge Ryan Alden. And then they reversed course 2 years later, just weeks after George Floyd got murdered by police, and just after the civil lawyer for Mr. Molina publicly released the video, because now the public could see the harm that Mr. Molina suffered. And now, with that public pressure, now their initial determination to look the other way was untenable, and they reversed course and decided to finally charge Ryan Alden for it. And that was in 2020, and it's almost 2 years on now, and the case is still stalled out. It's still on the books. Ryan Alden is still drawing a paycheck from the county taxpayers, and we don't have any resolution of those charges.
So as district attorney, would you recuse yourself in such cases and call for an independent investigative agency to be assigned?
I think that's part of the solution, but I don't think it's the whole solution. I've seen reforms where in cases where the most serious cases, police shootings or deaths of people at the hands of police officers, that those investigations and those determinations should be taken out of the local prosecutor's office hands and put into the state Department of Justice hands. Because theoretically, the State Department of Justice is not going to have as close a relationship with the local police agency as the county prosecutor's office. And that makes a certain amount of sense. But I'd go further than that, because when we have the more routine cases, the less serious, but still very serious cases where people are not killed, but are harmed in the course of an interaction with police, where there's some sort of rough interaction, and you see a case come in where somebody's charged with resisting arrest, but no charge that they were originally being arrested for. And then that person obviously, 9 times out of 10, is going to have bruises and scratches all over their body because it was some rough use of force. Those kinds of cases also need to be investigated by people who are at arm's length from that cozy relationship with police. So I believe that what those kind of more routine cases require is a special division within the district attorney's office that only handles those kinds of cases, and therefore doesn't have the chance to build up that usual working relationship with the law enforcement agencies.
The Oregon Criminal Justice Commission study released in 2019 listed Washington County Sheriff's Office as one of the law enforcement agencies that disproportionately stop people of color at traffic stops. Senate Bill 1510 was just passed by the 2022 Oregon legislature, which will reduce racial disparities in traffic stops by making a single headlight, taillight, or brake light out a secondary offense. Can you talk about the importance of such a law?
I supported 1510. It's a really responsible, reasonable, balanced reform designed to reduce those disparities. And I'm hopeful that it will go at least part of the way in doing what it sets out to do. To clarify, my understanding is that the state data has shown that Washington County Sheriff's Office, when they have drivers stopped, when those drivers are Latinos, Washington County Sheriff's Office, along with the two other largest law enforcement agencies in Washington County, Beaverton Police Department and Hillsborough Police Department, have disproportionately negatively treated Latino drivers during the course of those traffic stops. It's not that they necessarily stopped them disproportionately in the first place, but they've been more likely to search them, more likely to issue citations, and more likely to arrest them during the course of those traffic stops. And that's unfortunately true in a lot of agencies nationwide, where we're seeing a disproportionate use of, for instance, searching a car for drugs when it comes to drivers of color than when you're looking at white drivers, even though drugs are more likely to be found in the searches of white drivers than drivers of color. Those kind of outcomes of stops are not directly addressed by this recent legislation because, as you said, the recent legislation makes certain traffic offenses like having one taillight out a secondary offense as opposed to the kind of offense that you can get stopped for in the first place. You can still get a ticket for having your taillight out, but only if you got stopped for something like speeding or running a red light in the first place. And that's important because it's going to, in theory, reduce the incidence of what's called pretextual traffic stops. Pretextual traffic stops are where law enforcement decides that they want to stop somebody for any reason under the sun, a hunch, or in the worst scenario, because the person has the wrong color skin and is driving the wrong car in the wrong neighborhood at the wrong time, and law enforcement decides they want to stop that person. The law says that they're allowed to do it if that's their real reason, so long as they can find a legitimate reason to point to, a pretextual reason to point to. So long as they can say that person had a taillight out, then I'm going to stop that car, even if the real reason for stopping the car wasn't the taillight at all. Even if you go 100 times a day seeing cars with taillights out and you don't stop them, but you're stopping this guy, the law says that's okay. But what this law does is try to reduce the incidence of that happening by saying, we're not going to let you just pull people over for these measly, you know, infractions. Instead, you're going to deal with them as they come up in the course of, you know, interactions that have more to do with actual moving violations or traffic safety, but you're not going to just pull people over because you see something like that. And the Oregon District Attorneys Association has, you know, big surprise, opposed 1510, specifically opposed this traffic stop portion of 1510, and said that, well, those are traffic safety issues and we need to make sure that the police are able to do their job and it's an important part of investigations. But look, I was a federal prosecutor in another state, Arizona, where the law already was on the books looking an awful lot like 1510. you weren't allowed to pull people over for having one taillight out when they had a working taillight in Arizona. And you know what? The sky didn't fall. Law enforcement was still able to pull people over for actual traffic safety violations. They were still able to build criminal cases and stop, you know, and make investigations work. All that happened was that people's rights were protected a little bit more. So that's what 1510 sets out to do, and it's a good idea.
Aid and assist continues to be an issue in Washington County. This is when a person in custody in the county jail is found by the court to be mentally incompetent to aid in their own defense. Now, according to Oregon law, they must be transferred to restorative treatment within 7 days. Instead, they are lingering in the Washington County Jail up to 40 days without treatment. This is due to lack of supports and resources for people with mental illness in the community, but it is also due to the Washington County District Attorney, who chooses to prosecute individuals for low-level, nonviolent crimes who need mental health treatment and not jail.
Yeah. I mean, it's a crisis. We should not be having people with serious mental illness in the jail. And we do. And the jail ends up being one of the largest mental health providers in the county because we're not doing enough to address mental illness in the community. And people spiral, and some percentage of them end up getting arrested for a crime and end up in the jail. And when you don't treat those problems in the community, when you don't invest in that social safety net, then you see them all filter down into the jail, where it is completely ineffective at solving problems, it is inefficient, and it is the most expensive place to try to solve problems. Now, we need more support for the Oregon State Hospital to have more bed space for the people that it needs to be treating. But what we really need, even more than that, is to have more community support for people who have mental illness, because we wouldn't need to be having all these people waiting around at the jail to go to the state hospital if we had supports in the community that people could be released to have their treatment here in the community. We need a balanced approach that's going to incorporate a lot more treatment options and building up that social safety net that has too long been neglected here in Washington County. And the truth is, it's neglected because it's directly in competition with incarceration and with fanatical criminal justice system and the approach of the district attorney's office to lock up more and more people. It's taking away resources that we need to address those kind of problems in the community. We shouldn't be criminalizing mental illness. We're not going to arrest our way out of the problem of people having serious mental illness. We're not going to incarcerate our way out of the problem of people having serious mental illness. Yes, there are people who are so dangerous, they need to be held apart from the rest of the community. And, you know, that's an unfortunate but true fact. But there's also people that we should be helping and can be helping in the community, and we need to be doing it. We need to not be locking up so many people when the root cause of their problem is something like mental illness. We also need to not be doing it again and again and again for the same people. We need to be getting them into the treatment that's going to solve their problems, rather than just having this revolving door where we hold them for a period of time as punishment, let them out, and then expect somehow something's going to change. No, they just keep coming back through the system. We have the worst rate of recidivism in the metro area here in Washington County because we're not actually rehabilitating people who have underlying problems, and we need to be focusing on that.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. I'm speaking with Brian Decker, candidate for District Attorney of Washington County. So, Brian, I'd like to give you an opportunity to now talk about any issues in Washington County that you'd like to address.
Well, I'm sure we'll get to a lot of issues that are of concern to me, but the one that is at the front of my mind right now is just recently in the news, there has been this case of 27 women incarcerated at Coffee Creek Prison who were sexually assaulted by a prison nurse there. And Kevin Barton's district attorney's office declined to prosecute that nurse for these offenses. And then it was left to the Department of Justice, to the federal government, the prosecutor, you know, the same department that I used to work for as a prosecutor, to come in and charge that nurse when Kevin Barton wouldn't do it in the state courts. And it's pretty shocking because the way Kevin Barton has been talking about prosecution, he's been saying we're going to charge every crime that comes through the door. He's saying we're going to protect every victim, no matter who it is. But when it comes to those sexual assault survivors, because they are also defendants, because they are also people who have a criminal record, his office decided, well, nobody's going to believe them. Or at the very least, his office didn't believe them. Without even going out and interviewing these women as witnesses, they just decided it looked too hard to bring that case. That's not the way that it ought to be. It's also just indicative of, you know, this lack of trust that the community has in the criminal justice system, because when you're picking and choosing who you're protecting, when you're picking and choosing who gets special treatment, it just makes the whole system lack legitimacy. That causes everybody in the community to lack a sense of fairness and a sense of trust that their criminal justice system will protect them no matter what.
Now, we talked about youth being charged with felonies and people with severe mental illness lingering in the jail. So can you talk about collateral consequences of charging someone with a crime or spending even a short term in a county jail?
Yeah, this is such an important point. When people go to jail or when they end up with a criminal conviction on their record, often they're not just suffering the direct consequences of that punishment. They're not just suffering the sentence. They also have all these other consequences that go along with it. You know, when we look around and we see this homelessness crisis, we've got to understand the role that incarceration plays in that crisis, because people who have been formerly incarcerated experience homelessness at 10 times the rate of the general population. And that makes sense when you think about it, because if you think about what it would be like to spend some time in jail, even a few days, if you are already living paycheck to paycheck, if you already have the kind of job where you are trying to pick up as many shifts as possible, you might lose that job because you missed a shift or two. And losing that job might mean that you can no longer afford rent and you get evicted from your apartment. So even a short jail stay can make those dominoes fall. And then over and above that, you think about the consequences of having a criminal conviction on your record and how much harder that would make it to apply for a new job, how much harder that would make it to apply for a new apartment to rent. So it's not surprising that when we have so much unnecessary incarceration and instead are just doing punishment for punishment's sake, it is actually harming those people through these kinds of collateral consequences. And in harming those people, it's also harming the rest of us as a society by driving up that sort of trauma and driving those problems like homelessness and mental illness and addiction that end up creating this feedback loop and creating more crimes of desperation and having people cycle back into the criminal justice system again and again and again. That's why we need to focus more on rehabilitation as a primary form of accountability. That example is just for housing. And then you think about youth who are charged as juvenile delinquents. If they are incarcerated as youth, if they spend any time in juvenile detention as youth, they're much more likely to end up cycling back through the criminal system as adults. And that's because that early heavy-handed incarceration creates all sorts of collateral consequences that makes it more difficult for them to thrive throughout their life. For instance, certain kinds of convictions can prevent them from even being eligible to get access to the same student loans that the rest of us would be able to access. And then you take the example of folks who have mental illness. A stay in jail and away from their primary residence can reset the clock on their access to disability benefits and the kind of benefits that they need to get access to the treatment that they need to treat the underlying problem, which means that unnecessary incarceration, criminalizing mental illness, can have this perverse effect of actually exacerbating mental illness, of actually making people spiral more by denying them the treatment that would make them better.
And all the more reason, Brian, for these specialty courts and diversion programs that divert people into services and support instead of incarceration. So can you talk about what's available in the county and what more is needed?
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, there is some good in that we do have the structures in place for several different specialty courts in the county. We have a mental health court. We have a drug court. We have a veterans court. The problem with the way that those are being used by the district attorney's office is that they're not being maximized. They're not being used to their full potential to emphasize rehabilitation. And that's primarily for two reasons. Number one, it's that for the most part, those courts are probationary rather than diversionary, which is to say, in order to get into those specialty courts and avoid prison, you have to work your whole way through a criminal case, sometimes sitting in jail for several months, in any event, going to several different court proceedings, getting a lawyer appointed for you, talking through whether or not you're going to go to trial, and making a decision to accept a plea deal. And then you end up having that conviction on your record while you are going through probation and having, you know, trying to get that treatment. And as we just talked about, when you have that conviction on your record, when you've had that jail stay, you are already starting from behind the starting line when you're trying to get access to this treatment. You're already having a setback with that additional harm started. So what we need to do is have those programs be diversionary and have the diversion start earlier on in the process. We can't have this inefficiency of having people have to go through their entire, you know, series of court proceedings, sit in jail for several months before they finally get access to the services. We need to get people access to what is going to rehabilitate them sooner rather than later so that we're not filling up the jails and overburdening the courts. The second reason that those programs are not being used efficiently is that the district attorney has artificially created strict requirements for who is eligible to get into them and who is not. Just having a laundry list of crimes where if you're charged with that crime now, or if you have any conviction for that crime in the past, you're all of a sudden not eligible at all, no matter the circumstances, to get into these rehabilitation courts. And so we're seeing lots of cases where the judges who run the courts are saying, this person is a good candidate and needs to get into this court for rehabilitation. The probation officers who supervise the people when they're in the court are saying, this person is a good candidate and needs to get into this court for rehabilitation. And then the district attorney saying, nope, sorry, they have the wrong kind of conviction on their record from 15 years ago. And that disqualifies them according to our artificial rubric of who is allowed in these courts and who is not. For instance, I keep hearing Kevin Barton talk about how proud he is that the court has this new mental health diversion court. And I'm glad that the court has this new mental health diversion court. The court has been trying to have that for years, and the district attorney's office has been fighting against it and lost ultimately, and it has happened. So I'm glad that we have it. But the district attorney's office is imposing such artificially strict requirements on it that at this point they have let nobody into it. It is a court that exists entirely on paper with nobody actually benefiting from it several months after it has launched.
Racial disparity exists at every level of our criminal legal system, and DAs can influence the extent of racial disparity in sentencing. So what about your background has prepared you to effectively address issues of racial disparity?
Well, look, I've had to learn a lot of hard lessons about the criminal justice system and its effect on racial disparity, about its origins and about the way it has been perverted and contorted by some politicians with various agendas in a way that harms a lot of people, even when it pretends to be racially neutral, even when it pretends to be colorblind. There's several things the district attorney doesn't get to do with in relation to the police, doesn't get to set the policies for any police department or sheriff's department. doesn't get to set funding for any police department or sheriff's department, doesn't get to tell the police what to do and what not to do. But all of the decisions that the district attorney makes about what crimes to charge, who to charge, what pleas to offer, what sentences to recommend, what evidence to use and not use in trials and criminal cases, those decisions can drive police decisions in one direction or another. So if you have an unscrupulous district attorney who is willing to use illegally seized evidence, evidence that violates our constitutional rights, then that provides an incentive for the police to, you know, go out and violate people's constitutional rights, to try to get a search in at any cost, even when it is violating somebody's rights because it's without a warrant or and without any exception, or to use deceit and avoid Miranda warnings when they should be issued. If the police know that the district attorneys are going to turn around and at least try to use that evidence anyway, then there's some incentive to use those unconstitutional tactics. If, on the other hand, you have a district attorney's office that adheres to the Constitution and takes our rights seriously and says, when there's evidence that the police are bringing that violates people's constitutional rights, that violates equal protection principles, that violates the Fourth Amendment, we're just not going to even pretend that we're able to use that. We're not going to hold that over anybody and threaten to use that in court. Then that provides the opposite incentive for the police to not waste their time going after people in this unconstitutional way, and instead to strictly adhere to our constitutional rights when they're conducting their investigations. In Washington County, we've had a district attorney's office that is fanatical about getting wins at trial, using every piece of evidence they think that they possibly can, even if it is unconstitutional, even if it's something that violated somebody's rights and the law says it shouldn't be used. And so they end up pursuing lots of cockamamie theories that violate the Constitution, trying to get this evidence in. And sometimes they're successful at the trial court level, and then it ends up getting very often reversed when it goes up to the appellate court. In fact, Washington County District Attorney's Office, in the time that Kevin Barton has been in office, has had 260 cases reversed or vacated or reversed in part in Oregon's appeals courts. Those are cases where, you know, many times they had to go to trial, and now that whole trial is wasted, is a nothing, because the case has to come back down for a do-over. I mean, set aside the violations of people's rights, set aside the racial disparities and the civil liberties issues in all of those problems. Look at the waste. Look at the, you know, tremendous mismanagement of our resources, tremendous mismanagement of victims who now have to be re-traumatized going through court over again because the district attorney's office didn't do it right the first time. The rate at which those reversals happen for the Washington County District Attorney's Office, no other county in Oregon comes close to that because of this extreme fanatical pursuit of trial court wins and convictions at all costs.
And speaking of rights, now there is a large Hispanic community in Washington County. And as DA, under which circumstances would you communicate with ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, about a person's immigration status?
Never, unless there's some extraordinary circumstance where we're somehow legally required to, under threat of court order or something like that. It is violating Oregon's sanctuary state policy. And that's one of the problems with the current office's approach to ICE is Kevin Barton actually wrote a policy for the office that violated Oregon's sanctuary state laws that said that under certain circumstances where they think that a person that they're prosecuting is undocumented, they will pick up the phone and rat that person out to ICE. even when ICE doesn't come to them, even when it's not on the radar of the federal government. And that's ridiculous. I mean, that is violating the longstanding principles and policy of this state to avoid that entanglement with the enforcement of federal immigration laws. And it's bad policy because it decreases community trust in the office. It decreases the willingness of immigrants and other vulnerable communities to coordinate with law enforcement and coordinate with the district attorney's office when oftentimes that's necessary. And it puts them in a very difficult position and a difficult dilemma where they're, you know, having to deal with, in some cases, really serious crime in the community, but they have to make this cost-benefit analysis and this trade-off in their minds about, do I do anything about this or do I do nothing? Because doing anything risks these catastrophic immigration consequences that are completely disproportionate to anything involved.
And Brian, you mentioned vulnerable people, and you also talked about the women at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville. So can you talk about the rights of victims and what more would you do as DA to protect victims' rights?
Well, I think this is so essential. Victims' rights are enshrined in the Oregon Constitution. Victims, generally speaking, have a right to know what's going on in court, to be consulted by the district attorney's office as it makes its various decisions, and to be notified about developments in the case. Victims' rights are not opposite the rights of the accused. Victims' rights and the rights of the accused are both human rights. They are rights that belong to all of us, because all of us at any point could be accused or could end up as a victim or a survivor. And as somebody who was a public defender for years, let me tell you, the hundreds of people that I represented, almost every single one of those people accused of a crime has also been a victim of a crime in the past. Those are examples of people who are entitled to both, are entitled to victims' rights and are entitled to the rights of the accused. The problem with the approach I've seen from the incumbent here in the district attorney's office in Washington County is viewing those victims' rights on their own, outside of the needs of victims and survivors for healing and accountability at all stages of their development. For instance, we can check all these checkboxes about, okay, we've done our duty to notify victims, we've done our duty to consult with them before making these decisions. And then when it's a victim who absolutely wants to see this defendant go to prison and go to prison for the maximum sentence, you know, maximize retribution, then we here being the current Washington County District Attorney's Office, will go into court and wear the mantle of that victim and say, look, you need to make sure that you have justice for this victim by maximizing the sentence for this person. But the truth is, victims come in all shapes and sizes and have all sorts of needs and desires and feelings about what happened to them and about the person that harmed them. Most people who are victims knew the person who harmed them, knew the person who's responsible for what brought them into court in the first place, and so do have complicated feelings toward that person. And yes, some of them do want to see maximum retribution. Some of them want to see maximum mercy, maximum leniency toward that person. Most are somewhere in between, or change back and forth on a day-to-day basis, or hold, you know, two conflicting feelings at the same time about what should happen. We need to be taking into account that there are survivors who have lots of different feelings about what happened to them and about what is the best process going forward, whether going to court is going to be traumatizing or not, whether it's really best for them and their children, if their children's other parent goes to prison for years and years, or whether it's best for them if they go into court and speak their truth in front of all of those people, or is it traumatizing to them if they have to go into court and answer questions from various lawyers. We need to make sure that we have options available for all shapes and sizes of victims. That's why I think that one of the really necessary things we need to develop is a restorative justice program, which is essentially an alternative to the traditional court model, the traditional prosecution model, where in certain circumstances, if it's what the victim wants, we instead have a sort of mediation, and the victim and their family get to explain what happened to them. And the person responsible for the harm and their family and their network get to explain the context of how this horrible decision came to be made. And then both parties get what they need in terms of healing. And the responsible party gets access to whatever they need to take responsibility and make sure that they never repeat that behavior again. And this has been very successful in other communities where it's been implemented. It has increased victim satisfaction with their feelings of safety, with their feelings of fulfillment and healing in the outcomes of cases. And it has decreased the recidivism of the people responsible. In other words, it has decreased the chances that those people end up back in the system after having gone through this process, end up rearrested again within a few years of it. And that's so essential because that recidivism rate, that rate at which people get rearrested or reoffend after going through the system, is highest in Washington County out of the whole metro area. Over 50% of people who go through the Washington County criminal justice system get rearrested within 3 years for reoffending because we're not doing enough to actually address those underlying problems. We're not actually doing that rehabilitation. And instead, with this unnecessary incarceration, we're making things worse oftentimes.
Oregonians did pass Measure 110 that will connect people with drug treatment and recovery services, but it will also remove criminal penalties for small amounts of personal possession of drugs. So can you talk about that and also talk about what defund the police means to you?
I'll start with the second part first. And I've heard my opponent throw around this phrase, defund the police, as a sort of boogeyman. And, you know, mention it in the same breath as Portland and lawlessness and, you know, raising the specter of somehow opening the floodgates at prisons and letting all the bad people out. And that's supposed to be super scary for you. And it's the same kind of disinformation campaign and fear-mongering that we've seen from a particular corner of criminal justice politics for decades. It's powerful. It's powerful because it's based on fear. And fear shuts down that part of your brain that is responsible for common sense and reason. I think the hope is, but for the people who are using this rhetoric, fear will make them not consider any other alternatives, not consider problem solving, and instead just vote for them. I have been consistent about what I believe should happen with public safety funding. We do need to have essential police services to investigate and solve serious crimes and to respond to violent emergencies. We do need to have jails and prisons to hold people who are dangerous away from the rest of us. Those are necessities. And you can talk about how unfortunate or whatever those necessities are, but they're necessities. And we need to make sure that we're funding those things. But we also need to take a broader view of public safety, because every law enforcement agent I've ever spoken to has said, we're asking the police to do too much. The police are spending so much of their time responding to mental health crises, responding to welfare checks, dealing with homelessness and addiction and all these problems that they are ill-equipped to solve, because they're the only people we ever ask to go solve those problems. And that's a bit of an exaggeration, but we're divesting from all the other community-based solutions that could be addressing those problems. And we need to reverse that course. We need to expand our definition of public safety and expand our allocation of resources to treatment programs, to housing programs, job training, education, even infrastructure, these kinds of things that can get out in front of these problems and provide some support to the police, provide some support to the prison system so that those things that are supposed to be our last resort in an emergency aren't our first resort all the time. Measure 110 is one example. Measure 110 passed less than 2 years ago statewide. And in Washington County, people voted for it 2-1, even greater margin than it passed statewide, because Washington County voters less than 2 years ago recognized that this sort of drug war mentality of using the police and using prisons and using the criminal justice system as the only solution to addiction and mental illness has failed. We have tried it for half a century and it's gotten us to where we are. And what we need to start doing is recognizing that these are public health problems and treating them with public health solutions. And a part of that is decriminalizing the simple possession of small amounts of drugs, because those are addiction issues. There's nothing inherently based in those situations that say that police need to be involved because somebody has an addiction issue. Now, if addiction leads to actual crimes that are harming people, that are violent, that are property crimes, what have you, then those people need to be held accountable for those crimes. Absolutely. So what Measure 110 did is create, by freeing up our criminal justice resources, by, you know, unclogging the system of people who are otherwise charged with just the simple possession of a small amount of drugs, we can instead divert those resources to treatment programs. And so the state legislature has allocated $300 million for the implementation of ballot measure 110, programs that serve people in Washington County for addiction or mental illness or housing, have received over $3 million in grants from the legislature due to the implementation of ballot measure 110. It is already helping people on the ground. Now, the criticism I've heard is that the rate at which the police are actually issuing people tickets for simple possession of drugs, and then the rate at which people who have those tickets are going into treatment programs, is pretty small. The numbers are pretty small. But the problem with looking at those statistics and those statistics only is that, again, that is stuck in the lens of we're only looking at the drug problem through law enforcement. We're only looking at those people who get access to treatment because the police wrote them a ticket. What about all the other people who get access to better treatment before the police ever get involved? That's the real benefit of Measure 110, that we are doing things so far upstream, we're not seeing that those people get access to treatment when we're only looking through the criminal justice system.
Brian, you talked about trust of the district attorney. How should the citizens of Washington County hold you accountable?
Accountability and transparency are so important because they relate to everything that the district attorney does. All of those decisions that the DA makes, what crimes to charge, what pleas to offer, what sentences to recommend, generate a lot of data. And the DA's office keeps that data. And I know that they have it now because every so often they'll trot out some particular statistic about, commercial burglaries are up by 15% year over year when it suits a particular narrative. But I believe that all that data ought to be available to the public so that the public can look at everything in the aggregate and see the work that the district attorney's office is doing and see whether the policies that the district attorney is setting are really leading to the outcomes that are the goals or really leading to the outcomes that the community wants to see. All of that data ought to be available on a dashboard on a website so that the public can inspect what's going on, because sunlight is the best disinfectant. But then the other piece of that is actual accountability, some sort of body with real teeth that can oversee what the district attorney's office is doing. And I believe that that sort of commission ought to be made up of individuals who are representing communities that are most impacted by the criminal justice system, our Black and Brown communities, people with disabilities, LGBTQ+ folks, people who are most impacted by crime, and people who are most impacted by the criminal justice system itself, so that they have a voice in making sure that what our criminal justice system is doing is working for everybody in the community. And I'd like to develop that sort of transparency and accountability in the office, because I need people to hold me accountable. I'm doing my work to make sure that we reverse some of these horrible problems with the criminal justice system while keeping us safe and while holding people accountable. But try as I might, I'm just one person with just one perspective. And not for nothing, I'm a 40-year-old straight white guy with a beard, and there's far too many people who look like me in positions of power in our government. And we need more diverse voices holding people who look like me accountable. So I want to develop something like that because I honestly think that could be a real legacy.
Brian, can you give contact information for your campaign?
Absolutely. You can find us on the website, which is deckerforda.com. We are also on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and it is all DeckerforDA. You can also reach out to me at brian@deckerforda.com.
I've been speaking with Brian Decker, candidate for Washington County District Attorney. Thank you so much, Brian, and good luck.
Thank you very much.